Hi, welcome to BCI Cattle Chat. This is our 100th episode, and I'm joined today by Bob Larson, Bob Weber, and Dustin Pindell. Hi, guys.
Hey, good morning.
Hello.
We're happy to have everybody here, and we're all chiming in remotely, but we wanted to be sure that we could get this 100th episode, and we appreciate you joining us. We are glad that you're with us and have been with us through this process. And as always, anytime we appreciate your feedback. In fact, this whole episode is going to be dedicated to listener feedback, and we've asked for questions and we've received quite a few. If we don't get to your question on the air, then we'll send you a response to that question. If we did answer your question, we're going to be sending you a BCI Cattle Chat prize, so you'll be receiving that in the mail relatively soon. So we want to get to all those listener questions as we go through, and we've got some really good ones, and they range from questions on economics to genetics to at the end, and you want to stick around because there we're going to talk some about how do we envision, what are some of the big challenges we faced, and what are some of the things that we would recommend relative to profitability. If you have questions after this podcast or things that you'd like us to talk about, as always, you can send us an email at bci@ksu.edu, or you could contact us on Twitter @_BCI. So we're happy to have this discussion, and I'm going to kick off, guys. I'm excited that we've got some of these listener questions. I know you've corresponded with some other people, but these are the 8 questions that have made it to the podcast, and I'm going to start out with number 1, and this is a question from Kansas, and the question is really related to they've had some contracted tendons in their calves. So these are the calves that when they're born, they're kind of knuckled over a little bit, or they may have that contraction in the tendon in the back of their leg that makes it look kind of like they're flexing their leg. So can you guys tell us what causes that? And they had, in this herd, they had 3% of them that had some contracted tendons, so they're a little bit concerned about, is it an outbreak, or what sort of problem are they dealing with here?
Well, I'm going to jump in on this one and just say that there's probably some things we don't fully understand about contracted tendons, but what we think we understand is it's more common in large calves, and we think a lot of the issue really just has to do with being crowded in the final few weeks of the birth of gestation of pregnancy and having those front legs really turn back so that when they're born, they've really been contracted while the last part of pregnancy.
So now, you'll see a lot of times in twins.
Yeah, large calves or twins, anytime that uterus is really crowded. Now, the good thing is that there's some things we can do about that. It takes some nursing care. It's a hassle, but basically you can put a splint on them, or sometimes we'll actually glue a board to the bottom of their foot to kind of help stretch out their toes. So there's a few things you can do, and then over the next few days, usually those tendons really stretch out, and they're able to stand and walk and do pretty well. So that's probably the most common situation we see. And so why it would show up in a group might be, that we're having larger calves this year because of anything that's causing larger calves. It could be some nutritional or other environmental factors that we're not really completely aware of.
But we don't see it very often in groups. And I want to go back to, so splints or a toe block only in the really severe cases. So most of those, even if they're pretty contracted, they're going to stretch out. But it depends on the severity of those cases, and that's a place you may want to talk to your veterinarian about what makes sense in this calf, because we don't see those every year.
Exactly.
Excellent. So question number 2 comes from Minnesota. And in this one, I think this is an interesting question, and a lot of people will face this. So young producer, relatively small herd, AIs the cows, and keeps heifers to continue to grow the herd. So he's building the herd growth-wise. Calves in the spring, wants to breed those heifers at 14 or 15 months of age so that they calve as a 2-year-old. 100% I agree with that approach. The question comes down to, and I'll infer a little bit in because I think many of us face this challenge, you don't have a lot of separate pastures to put these cattle in. So he says, how long do I have to keep that replacement heifer separate before putting her back in the herd? So I wean her in the fall. Can I put her back in right away? And I may start this with Dustin. Tell us a little about the importance of economics of those replacement heifers.
So I guess, when do they, did you say they springing in the, or they, they're born in the fall, spring?
Born in spring, weaned in the fall.
Okay. So I guess, he's wanting to keep the replacement heifers. So like, some things to think about, I guess thinking about when they're going to be bred, when they're going to be thinking about the prices of cattle, when they're going to be, when they're going to be breeding, when they're going to be selling those calves, thinking about a spring calf versus the fall calf. Other things would be the availability of feeds, availability of labor, some of the feed prices, the seasonality, taking those, some of those things into account. I think, is that what you were, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, so and a lot of cost goes into raising that heifer, and keeping her in the herd is critical. So, the convenience part of putting her back in the herd, but I want her to calve her second calf in the herd. And Larson and Weber, I'll turn to you guys. What do you guys think? How soon before you could put her back in? So let's say, I'll give you some dates. I weaned her in October. When can I put her back with the cows?
So we weaned her calf in October. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. I would really, so would and should, maybe we'll say it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would probably prefer to keep that cow really managed separately until she's well into her pregnancy for her second pregnancy.
Oh, wow. That's a long time, Bob.
It is a long time, but it's kind of like what Dustin was saying. We've got a lot of expenses into these heifers, and and the biggest risk I have for an animal to drop out of the herd is really after that first pregnancy. And yeah. So I want to, and I can't really afford to lose them that early. After I put this much money into them, I need them to get pregnant for their second pregnancy and really hold that through. And so that's why I say I should probably manage them separately until they're well into their second pregnancy. Now, I understand the problems of, you know, a limited number of pastures, labor, those kinds of things. And so all I would say is that if you can, put them in with the mature cows earlier, but you better monitor them and really watch those girls. And if forage is limited this year because of a drought or other situations, they would be the first ones to need some additional management.
Yeah, I agree, Bob. I think your point on you know, those young females being the high risk ones for fallout is dead on. And for a small producer, one of the strategies that I think makes a fair bit of sense is at least for the post weaning period until you get them bred. You know, that may be some kind of confinement or small lot separate feeding, and actually do a pretty modest heifer development program. So you get those heifers to probably somewhere 65-70% of their mature weight at least by breeding time, and that'll help make sure those females are ready to breed. In a number of cases, it's fairly easy to do that with today's genetics, and so maybe even targeting something in the 75% of their body weight to give you a little insulation, so that if you do have to turn those females with the mature cows for the summer grazing period, they'll still gain weight and gain enough to be at a reasonable target for calving as a two-year-old and good body condition score, probably with some protein supplementation next winter. But take advantage of the time that you need them separated and get some groceries into those girls and get them developed along. And if you're a small producer, you know, you're already not in the least cost sort of production mode anyway, and taking care of those females with a little extra feed probably makes some sense.
One thing I'll just add real quick, another thing before you decide to keep your replacement heifers, you might just look and just pencil out the numbers and make sure that it makes sense to keep your own replacement heifers versus possibly going out into the market looking at buying replacement heifers.
Great strategy for small producers.
Great point. And especially with as long as it takes. So I agree, Bob, with your recommendation. And anything else is a compromise, right? So if I put them back into the herd sooner, I certainly could do that, but I'm compromising a little bit. Maybe outsourcing those heifers would be important. Next question. I'm going to keep you guys moving because I want to get through as many of these as we can on today's show. And today's show is going to be a little bit longer than what we normally do. but we'll try to keep it close. Dustin, this question is to you, and it is, we did a podcast a few weeks ago on depreciation of cows, and the question was, how do I include that depreciation in a budget?
That's a good question. So I think if you go back, I believe that podcast was last fall, but first, you got to define what depreciation is. We define that as the purchase price or the replacement cost minus the salvage value divided by the productive years in the herd. And so thinking about this from a budget standpoint, or how do we incorporate that into a budget, I'd say there's probably a couple ways that people can do that or are doing that. They're raising, we just talked about the producer raise their own replacement heifers. And so if they're doing that, they're going to be selling fewer calves in the following year. So it'll be on the revenue side. So that's one way they're thinking about that purchase price or that replacement cost. It's also probably showing up in the cash flow, possibly by purchasing. So if they're purchasing replacement heifers, they're probably, they're purchasing those replacement heifers and selling fewer cows. And so if you purchase those replacement heifers, that's showing up in your income statement, your cash flow budget in the revenue side. You're either making more revenue or you're selling or getting less revenue from selling for your calves. The follow-up question to that we also received was, how are market trends important in thinking about depreciation? How is that showing up? The market trends are important because we talked about reducing the purchase price of replacement heifers and or trying to increase the salvage value of a cow. So you probably need to understand the cull cow markets and or the replacement heifer markets as well. So both of those show up in the numerator of a depreciation calculation. And so that's why you need to understand the market trends.
And so I think that's something that a lot of people, and based on your answer, there's quite a bit to that, and that may be a great example to reach out to an extension specialist, or there's some examples of budgets on Ag Manager Info. We'll put that link in the show notes. Great place to learn how to check that depreciation. So we appreciated that question from Illinois. We also got another Kansas question, and I'm going to address this to the Bobs. Okay, so this question is related to a producer who has been managing relatively high genetics, bringing them into the herd, has good bulls, have them tested, good feeding plan, but have had some calves. We talked about contracted tendons earlier. This is a little bit different. Has had some calves that might be what he would call dwarfs. So what do you think? In the contracted tendons, we said it's uterine crowding. Is the uterine crowding so extreme it made them dwarfs?
Well, probably, this is Weber, so probably not. There's a variety of causes that can result in dwarfism in beef cattle. And one of those is genetics. And so there's a couple of different known genetic mutations that cause dwarves. Those have been identified in a variety of different breeds. Typically a mutation that's autosomal recessive, which means that both the parents, the sire and the dam, both have to be carriers of that particular defect to produce a calf. And many times those particular mutations that cause the dwarfism segregate only within breed. So one of the diagnostic mechanisms we can use to help sort of identify, is this an environmental or pathological cause dwarf, or a genetic one, is understanding the breeding history of the herd. And so if they are purebred animals or full-blood animals of a particular breed, and there's been some inbreeding, so we can track the inheritance of this defective portion of the chromosome through both sire and dam through a procedure called identity by descent, then we might think that it might be genetic in nature. If it's a crossbred beef herd, the likelihood of it being genetic goes down dramatically.
Yeah. I think
one of the things that when I look at basically any birth defect in cattle is that, you know, the way that the calf looks, you know, whatever part of him is not developed correctly, almost in every situation, we know that there's a potential genetic cause that could end up with a calf that looks like that, a toxin that could make a calf end up looking like that, or a virus or an infectious agent that could cause the calf to look like that. And that's a real challenge to figure out, well, which is it? Is it genetic? Is it a virus? Or is it a toxin? And that's where working, again, so if it's a purebred animal, you have to keep genetics on the rule out list. If it's a crossbred animal, we're probably down to either a virus or a toxin. And then working closely with your veterinarian in a diagnostic lab to see if you could figure out where this problem is coming from. And that's true not only for dwarfism, but for really any kind of a birth defect. Now, the one other attribute that I would maybe throw into this concept is, are you talking about almost a true dwarf, or is it just a really small calf? And that may be due to a really short length of pregnancy in the dam, so that it's just born really early. So that's not really a dwarf, and he's going
to
grow.
I'm going to have to ask you a question. How do I tell the difference between a dwarf and a really small calf? Is that not the same thing?
The difference being that a dwarf is going to always be small and not grow out of it. A calf that's just born small will then go ahead and develop and grow like a normal calf would. And so I won't necessarily know that today, but I can figure that out fairly soon.
Yeah, so it's based on their growth rate. So it could be a small calf or a dwarf, but then if I look at them 3 months later and they're still small, then it's a dwarf.
Yes.
Right, because
And there's a couple of varieties of dwarfism, and one of the varieties produces a fairly deformed calf. It's not just a small calf. It's got anatomical features that aren't normal, and those are oftentimes called bulldog dwarfs. And so they've got really short limbs. Think of a little bit of kind of like a calf, but with corgi-sized limbs, right? So really shortened limbs, typically a deformed skull and mandible. And so I don't remember if the listener pointed out if these calves lived or died at birth. A lot of times the bulldog dwarf ones are born dead. Sometimes the other dwarfs that are just super small actually are born alive and may live for a period of time. So,
well, and you guys answer, and thanks to that question from Kansas, you guys answer ties right into the next question. This question is actually from South Africa. And this question was related to, you talked about a calf born small. So really two parts of this question, and I'm going to ask the Bobs, what is the heritability of gestation length in beef cattle? And part two, could we just use bulls with a shorter gestation length to prevent dystocia? Thoughts?
So great question. And gentlemen, evidence here now, we are worldwide, right? So we got listeners in South Africa. That's phenomenal. That's really cool. The gestation length actually turns out to be a really key component in our understanding of calving ease and dystocia events in beef cattle. And in fact, a number of the genetic evaluation systems here in the U.S. at one point or another have used gestation length as one of the trait components in the calving ease genetic evaluation. So the things they looked at were calving ease scores, birth weights, and gestation length records from known AI mating. So we have a good solid number for the days of gestation. And it turns out the heritability of gestation length ranges a little bit in the literature, typically from somewhere in the mid-0.2s, upward of Simmental, for example. A couple of literature estimates suggest in the mid to upper 0.3s, so about the same as weaning weight, really, is a good way to describe it, and has a correlated genetic response with obviously birth weight. So the shorter the gestation, typically the lighter the birth weight, and then a positive relationship with calving ease, or the percentage of calves born unassisted.
So Bob, let me interrupt for a second. I want to ask for a clarification. So a 0.2, similar to weaning weight, would you put that as highly heritable, lowly heritable, or somewhere in the middle?
Moderately heritable.
Moderately heritable.
Yep.
Okay,
yep.
In the middle.
So to kind of address what the questioner asked was, could we use pregnancy length or gestation length? And actually we probably are. When we're using lower birth weight bulls or higher calving ease bulls, they probably really are bulls that have a shorter gestation, or their calves have a shorter length of pregnancy. Now,
especially if they have a good weaning weight.
Yeah.
Right. Low birth weight, good weaning weight, may just be a gestation length.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Now that ties into, can you go too far? And I'm suspicious that I've seen some herds that could possibly go too far with that, as far as selecting a really low birth weight. Think of it as short pregnancy length or short gestation length, generation after generation, to the point where some of those calves in the herd have a really short gestation. And so now you're starting to talk about almost a premature or really early birth, which leads into calf being able to thrive at birth and those types of things, and being born too small. So yes, one of the ways we manage calving difficulty is to select bulls that have shorter length of gestation, or the calves are born just a little bit earlier, but you can take that too far.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, we see a little bit of that. I know in our purebred beef unit here at K-State, when we use really high calving ease bulls, we observe those heifers calve typically a week or 10 days early. Sometimes those calves come out and they're little 50 pounders. And so you're exactly right, I think, Bob, that, you know, we can take that a little too far. And I think maybe one of the potential solutions to that is sort of helping breeders understand those, the antagonism here, that, you know, you can take it too far, and actually selecting for animals that are high calving ease or acceptable calving ease, but are reasonable in terms of gestation length, may actually help us a lot in those calf survival issues. So, great listener question. Thanks for sending that from South Africa. Yeah. That's awesome.
Great question, and really ties into some of the other topics, that there's so many things to think about as we make our genetic selections, our calving season selections, trying to get the calves born alive and then make it to weaning. And then once we get to weaning and beyond, that's where this next listener question comes in. So this question is from a Kansas producer, but I will think this is going to be pretty typical throughout the country, because when I was in practice, we observed producers, and Bob, you and I talked before the show, you had producers the same way. And I'll outline the scenario and the basis for the question. So essentially, a spring calver, calves born in March, calves weaned in the fall, and then they have availability of grass in the summer. So between fall and the next spring, they have those calves gain very little weight per day. So they go all the way till the next spring, and they graze the grass that's available, and then they go to the feed yard. Alternatively, those calves could go to the feed yard or a backgrounder and then the feed yard when they're weaned in the fall, and they might be harvested at 13 to 15 months of age, versus the first scenario that I gave, they're harvested at 20, 22 months of age. Thoughts from the group, which way is better? And Dustin, I'd be interested in the economic perspective on this question.
So I just got one follow-up question to your question.
That's not how this game is played, Dustin. So I ask the questions and you give the answers.
So you said 13 to 15 months for the second scenario.
Yeah.
And then you said 20 to 22 months of first scenario?
Yep.
Who's the producer? Are these two different producers, I assume?
Nope. You get the producer, same producer, and these are my two options.
Okay.
And I'm going to own the calves all the way through.
Okay. So you've got to think about basically the cost, in my mind, and thinking about the you're going to have money tied up for an extra, 7, 8, 9 months in these calves.
Yep.
And that's the one thing that I would think about, the costs, having the money tied up into it. You know, you've got opportunity costs, but also think about don't forget about the risk, right? You're holding on to these cows for an extra, what we say, 7 to 9 months. And we saw what happened in the cattle markets in the last, month. And so there's a lot of opportunity for pretty volatile swings in the prices. So I guess I would think about that, you know, think about those opportunity costs, keeping your money tied up for an extra 9 months.
Yeah. Opportunity costs a big one, because you don't get a bill for it, but it's real. I think that's a great point.
I think this question really goes back to some of our discussions on when's the optimum time to plan my herd to calve. to try to hit both the forage production in my local facility as well as good markets. And the challenge in this type of a scenario, and I had clients that were in this ballpark that wanted to own their cattle from birth to slaughter, but they're in one so they live in one geographic area. And so to maximize optimize the forage production for their cows and the breeding and the calving and lactation of the cows, and then to have that same forage be optimized for their calves often doesn't work. If you just pull out the calendar, they don't align well. So there's a couple of ways people manage that. One is they use, some planted forages, ryegrass, wheat pasture, those types of things, so that they have green growing forages that can be grazed by these stalker calves or potentially the cows at times that then more closely matches with the age of that calf really wanting to be in that stalker segment. The other one is kind of the scenario you presented where actually I don't graze my own calves on my ground. I go ahead and sell them and put them through maybe right into the feedlot or something like that. And then I buy separate calves that were born at a different time or managed in a different part of the country and then bring them in to optimize the use of my grazing acres for stalker type of cattle. So long answer is it can get complicated really fast, and it's hard to optimize every phase of the industry if your forage production is, if you have dormant forage for much of the year, which would be true for most of the country. So pull out a spreadsheet, talk to some other experts and share ideas among people, because, one size does not fit all scenarios, but you do need to think through what your options really are.
I think, one of the, and I agree a lot with what you said, Bob, about, doing the planning part in particular and understanding those marketing windows. One of the things I think really can help define which one of those answers is best is really pin down when you're going to market the calves, right? So if we think about a typical February or March, April calver that wants to sell calf feds, well, those calves are at 15 months of age, are a marketing window that's the three low price months, June, July, and August. And that's when most of the fall or spring born calves go to market. And so if you can avoid that, it makes good market sense to sort of help manage risk on the price side. And so one of the ways to sort of hit that, if you've got a 13 to 15 month old calf and you want to be in a kind of a March, April marketing window for calf feds, means you've got a calf in January or late December to make that work. The alternative is push, as you suggest, the calving window to match forage resources. The only way to get into a better marketing window for those calves, if you're going to retain ownership on them, is basically become a stalker producer and delay entry into the feed yard on those animals using low cost forage production or forage grazing as a way to kind of stretch out the age. And one of the advantages of that too is that those older calves tend to grade a little bit better if you can manage the cost side of it. And that becomes really the key selling those 20 or 22 month old calves back into a February, March, April marketing window for the feds. Just controlling cost on the grazing part and managing that piece of the risk. So,
and I think Bob, I think you're absolutely right. You encouraged counter-cyclic behavior. So if I don't do what everybody else is doing, I might get better prices. And if I'm more efficient than everybody else, I might save money. I would go back to two things. One that Dustin said, consider the opportunity cost, and one that Bob said, make a spreadsheet because it's different than everybody. Because you're exactly right. You just described a scenario where it can work, but we want to make sure that for each of you, this is a great spreadsheet question or pull up and do the math, but include opportunity costs in your math, not just the, because we had a lot of guys do it and say, well, the winter feeding cost is not much, but you still had the opportunity cost there.
Yeah, do the enterprise accounting kind of exercise or enterprise budgeting to break out, well, how much is the stalker phase going to cost me, or how much money might I make? And if the market's favorable to make a whole bunch of money selling stocker cattle, that's an opportunity to actually kind of understand that part of the business and maybe capitalize on a lower risk but shortened ownership period. So,
yeah, I have saved the best two questions for last because we want to find out here, and these are opinion questions for you guys, but I think they will be relevant to all of our listeners. So the first one is, what is the biggest change that you, and this is a two-part question, what's the biggest change you've seen in the beef industry? And Bob, I'm going to ask you to go first.
All right. Well, there's actually, I can think of quite a few, but as a veterinarian, one that I don't know if everybody would think of this, but one of the things that really happened a couple of decades ago was introduction of some long-acting antibiotics, which really changed the way we could manage respiratory disease particularly, but some other conditions as well. When I was first in veterinary practice, basically, if you treated an animal for a disease, I really only expected that antibiotic to last 24 hours or less. And some of you
treated them daily.
Yeah, you treated them daily, which really changed the way we managed health management in cattle. So the advent of these longer acting antibiotics was really a big change.
Dustin?
So the biggest change that I've seen, which my time horizon is going to be a little different than Bob's, it's actually the exact same thing that he had mentioned, technology. I mean, that's what I put technology / social media, and that's just more recent. And I think thinking about today versus 20 years from now, I can kind of think about this technology, social media. I don't know a specific technology like Bob mentioned, but that was what I was going to say is technology.
Weber?
I'm going to stick to my genetics roots, and I'm going to say genomics in beef cattle selection and production. You know, as we look over the last 15 or 20 years, genetic evaluation in beef cattle has changed monumentally and
drastically different.
It's crazy different, and driven by as Dustin points out, pretty substantial uptake of technology by our business and in the seed stock sector.
So I'm going to go a little bit different than you guys. I said, even though it's not great yet, information transfer. And as an example, I used value-based pricing. So as cattle leave the feed yard, we haven't got there on the auction market yet. But I think those price signals have changed, and you look at things like CAB or other programs that have fed back through that system, it's changed our breeding programs on the cow-calf herd, even though we don't always get all the information back, but that information transfer. Second part of this question, and this time, Weber, I'm going to start with you. What's the biggest change you see coming? So we said, what's the biggest change we've seen? What's the biggest change you see coming?
Great question. Biggest thing I see coming. I want to. I'm going to stick to my genetics thing again. And
I thought you might.
Yeah. I'm actually hopeful we get to a spot where we've got much better product differentiation amongst feeder cattle. We know, when you get to the far end of the chain, there's dramatic differences in the value of cattle. It would be nice to be able to help our partners in the value chain communicate that difference in value clear back to the weaned calf stage. And we've got some tools that are developing. They haven't seen as broad an uptake maybe as they deserve, particularly on the genetic side. But I think, feeder calf pricing, I think, is something to look forward to.
Dustin, what do you think?
So you said the question was the biggest change that we're going to see in the future?
Yep.
That's a great question. I'm going to say it's going to come back to something related to consumers, technology, or the social media aspect. I think whether it's getting more information about what they're consuming, who their producer is, getting to know their producer, maybe somewhere in that space is what I don't know. I guess I have a specific, but that's
something in that area. Yeah. Bob?
Well, I'm going to stick with my story on antibiotics. You know, I was talking about, you know, one of the big changes has been some newer, really nice tools on that front. I think the future will be, how are we going to manage health in animals using less and less of antibiotics and other tools?
I think that's a good point. I'll say that I had down, in a word, transparency, which I think echoes exactly what Weber and Dustin said, and really goes right along with what you're saying, Bob, because one of the reasons we're going to use less antibiotics is partially driven by consumers and what they want. So if you're looking toward the future, be prepared to be open as we go to the next phase. And that may be both transparency and traceability. So last question, and this one, and we appreciate that listener question from Oklahoma. This question comes to us from Indiana, and I'm really interested to see what you guys think about this one. And this is, if you had a typical cow-calf producer, let's say 100 head, and they're looking for the next 10 years, and they want to focus on profitability, what would be a couple recommendations that you would tell them, be sure you do this to keep your herd profitable or to make it more profitable over the next 10 years? And this one, Bob, I'm going to start with you.
All right. Well, I'm going to try, you know, my interest is really some of the things we do reproductively with cows. So breeding soundness exams of bulls, body condition score monitoring of cows, and those types of things, all with the goal of really optimizing that reproductive efficiency. I want as many cows pregnant in the first 21 days of the breeding season as can be optimized, and really making sure that we have cows that can produce extremely well, but they have to be managed really well as in addition.
And I'll cut in there, Bob, because that was one that I had on my list, was have the calves born early. Same issue. Weber, what do you have down?
So I've got, and do you want one or both of these at the same time?
No, just do one, and then we'll go around
again. I think the first one's figure out how to build and leverage a planned crossbreeding system in your commercial cow herd. And that really goes, I think, a lot to the reproductive efficiency and longevity components of cow herds. So how do I retain maternal heterosis and leverage that? So that helps the things that Bob was talking about in terms of reproductive performance in the cow herd, but also helps control replacement female cost and depreciation.
Dustin?
So I broke these down into, I said profitability equals revenue minus cost. And so I broke them down into, I got one for revenue side, one for the cost side. And my revenue relates actually to both what Bob Weber or Bob Larson and Brad talked about. And I said, you know, you got to have something to sell. You got calf pounds times price. We don't really maybe control a price, but you can control, you know, or you got to have a calf to sell. So coming back to your efficiency and you know, sell and having a calf earlier in the season. So it's kind of a combination, I guess, of what you guys said.
Focus on the revenue. Get the and ideally you'd match that calf up that's born early in the season with the appropriate marketing channel. And we talked about that a little bit in some of these earlier things, so know that marketing channel. Now let's go for your second recommendation. Weber, we'll start with you.
All right, my second one is actually utilization of body condition scoring in your cow herd as a management tool to help inform nutrition and calf weaning dates in particular.
Excellent. And I think that gives us a key focus, and really that's going to focus too on making sure that I'm controlling that expense side appropriately with my nutrition. Larson, what's your second one?
Well, when I see both current and what I think will be future cow-calf producers that are really successful. They're really good at grass management. They're grass growers, they're grass harvesters, and they have, and again, kind of using Dustin's thought process of you know, prices or income over expenses, keeping my expenses controlled by, you know, maximizing the use of my grazed forages. So become a really good grass manager.
Larson, I'm not copying off you, but mine was minimize resource use and identify alternatives to decrease your reliance on stored forages, which is essentially what you just said, except it took me twice as many words to say it. So what you said was better, but it plays right into the expense side. Dustin, what was your last one?
So on the cost side, you know, you got to understand what your costs are, I think. And we've talked about that on previous podcasts. I broke that down into two, variable and fixed expenses. Kind of comes back to related to what you guys talked about. And I said, got to know what your feed costs are. You got to know what they are, and you got to be able to minimize, because that is your, generally, that's what, 60 to 70% of your cost. And then also I wrote down here, understand and know what your depreciation costs, because you've seen, in some of the different news outlets or, you know, news articles, that depreciation can be up to second or third most highest expense in a cow-calf herd. So mine was basically knowing your feed costs and maybe your depreciation costs.
So I think knowing both the income and the cost side is the key to being profitable as we go forward. And boy, I've just had a great time discussing these questions, and you guys have had a great response, and we sure appreciate the input that we get from all the listeners, especially on these questions. And this is our 100th episode, so I know we went a little bit long, but I want to get you guys' thoughts to reflect a little bit. And I'm going to hit you on the fly with this one, but this is not a listener question. This is a me question. What's been your favorite thing or some of the things that you've learned by doing this podcast?
Well, I'll jump in. One of the things that I always appreciate is getting to talk to people with other areas of expertise. You know, I like working with cattle. I like working with cattle producers, but working with Weber and Pendel and others and our guests, I keep learning stuff every podcast.
Weber, what about you?
You know, it's great. It sort of boggles my mind that we've done this now 100 times. It doesn't seem like it's been that long. And I guess one of the things I've really enjoyed is our guests and getting to know kind of more about their thoughts on the beef industry and how we work together and serve people around the industry. And you know, I think it's been a lot of fun, and I hope we make it to 200.
Dustin?
Yeah, I hate to be sound like a record, broken record, but I like the guests and listening to other people, you know, the non-economic talk, just to learn and understand more about the issues and learning the facts about the non-economic stuff.
The facts and or opinions.
You know? Or opinions.
I've enjoyed the interaction with listeners a lot. I think there's some value there. I've enjoyed the interaction with us and getting those different opinions and listening to you guys argue with each other over different things, I think is great and is good information for our listeners. So we appreciate you, the listener, for listening to the program. Again, if you have any comments, thoughts, suggestions, or things you'd like us to talk about, please send us an email at bci@ksu.edu.